www.ecosystemsmatters.org.
Good morning. This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're asking you to play state legislator. What would you do if you're elected to serve in Sacramento in either the Assembly or the State Senate, and you were facing a huge state budget shortfall? What kinds of actions would you take to try and close that shortfall? Yesterday, Democrats in the state assembly were pushing for a $1.2 billion a year tax that would have been applied to oil companies for extracting oil out of the ground in California. There also would have been a windfall oil profits tax that would have been applied to those California-based petroleum companies, the idea being that that would go at least partially to offset the nearly $5 billion in education cuts that Governor Schwarzenegger has proposed. The governor is considering a variety of options to close the multi-billion-dollar budget deficit, but Republicans in the Assembly and Senate have taken a pledge that they are not going to accept any increases in taxes for Californians. And on the Democratic side, they have said that taxes are a necessity, in their view, for whatever budget plan comes out of the legislature. So I'd like to hear from you your thoughts at 866-893-KPCC. We are joined by Democratic member of the state legislature, John Laird, the assemblyman from the 27th District, which is the Monterey-Santa Cruz area. He's chairman of the Assembly Budget Committee. Thank you, Assemblyman Laird, for being with us.
My pleasure, Larry.
Well, let's talk about this proposal to tax oil companies locally. I understand California, unlike other states, doesn't have such an extraction or windfall oil tax. This went to voters, though, a couple of years ago. They turned it down, and oil companies claim that there are so many other taxes they have to pay in California they don't pay elsewhere, that to then go ahead and levy the extraction tax would be unfair and make them have to pay the highest taxes in the country. Your response?
Well, just before getting to that, let's stand back a little and look at the budget situation that pushes this to the fore. And really quickly, there's been $7 billion of tax relief on an annual basis given to Californians in the last few years. And there's been a similar amount of money locked into spending that hasn't been related to medical care or education. And so because there's been this locked-in spending, because there's been $7 billion of tax relief, now everybody's saying, geez, you need to cut education and health care as a result of those two things happening. And we think it's unfair if a balanced approach got us into this of big tax cuts and locking in big spending, that to get us out of this, we need a similar balanced approach that's probably some measure of cuts and some measure of increased revenue.
Now, except for the vehicle license tax, which Governor Schwarzenegger repealed shortly after he was elected, what have been the other forms of tax relief to which you're referring?
For example, there have been some additional tax credits extended or changed. And one, which unfortunately is wildly popular and helps the middle class, that we're not enthusiastic about rolling back, but the legislative analyst has suggested we do it, is the change in the dependent deduction amount, which in constant dollars I think was $94 as a deduction for dependent, and then in the Gray Davis years, it must be children, was changed to $250 or $260. That's $1.2 billion to the economy or the general fund alone. And so there have been some changes in tax credits as well as the vehicle license fee, which at the time the governor rolled it back in 2004 was $3.8 billion. It would be $4.9 billion coming in on an annual basis now if we're still there. But the significant thing is the expenditure that went with it. That vehicle license fee went to cities and counties. The expenditure was locked into the Constitution and has even grown at a faster rate. That's $6.1 billion right now of expenditure for which there's no revenue. And so part of our problem right now is that people gave away the revenue, and yet they locked the expenditure in a constitution at a growing formula. And interestingly, I didn't support both ends of that. Most Democrats didn't. Most Republicans did. And yet they say we have a spending problem, and they say we need fiscal discipline. But that $6.1 billion came from them, and that's part of the big hole we have to fill right now.
So you're saying these automatic increases, that's what you're talking about?
In that case, but you see, everybody always says the automatic increase in the school's budget or the Prop 98 is a big problem, and yet if there hadn't been these revenue things and we didn't lock a few new expenditures into the Constitution, that formula would be working just fine. There would be enough revenue to distribute what is supposed to go to schools. Instead, the governor's recommending a $4 billion cut to schools, and we simply don't want to do it.
John Laird, Democratic Assemblyman, chairs the Assembly Budget Committee. Rick Keene, Republican State Assemblyman from Northern California. We thank you, Assemblyman, for joining us.
You bet. Good to talk to you, Larry.
Good to have you with us. As I understand, spending in California has gone up something like 30% since Governor Schwarzenegger has been elected to office. Is that accurate?
Well, over the last 4 years, it's gone up from a $78 billion budget in 2004 to $103.4 now. So, yeah, that's around 33% in that period of time, just in the last 4 years.
Okay. And so what are the reasons for this? Who's getting more money out of the state budget?
Well, it's been a lot of things. In fact, probably the biggest issue that happened, and given the discussion that we're having today, was 2 years ago, the education budget was enhanced by $10 billion, a $7 billion current enhancement, and another commitment to another three prospectively, which was an 18% increase. That year, we had $11 billion in new revenue and $15 billion in increased spending. And so that's really what kind of, at least was a giant chunk of it. Obviously, during that period of time, there was a lot of catching up of debt, paying off the ERBs and a lot of other activities. But even apart from that, the general fund itself grew by 33%. So there's been a huge increase in spending, about $25 billion during that time.
So with all this additional money, then the question is, in lean times, is there a way to make cuts that don't do significant harm to people who are recipients of those funds in recent years?
Well, and that's one of the problems is that every budget, as you know, Larry, I've been on the show several times during those discussions. We keep asking our friends on the other side of the aisle, given the volatility of our income stream, that we needed to put aside more for a rainy day, not to take all those new increases in funds and commit them to programmatic increases. Unfortunately, on the other side, we haven't had a willingness to acknowledge that, I think because there's a lot of pressure for government to do more and more. I understand that. But the difficulty is that it puts us in this bind. Once we start programs, then people see those as being very difficult to scale back. And that's the problem. We tend to ride the curves of an uptick in the stock market back in the late 90s through 2001, and then the recent rise in the sales of homes. And when those things turn down, so does our revenue stream.
Now, Assemblyman Keene, what about this pledge that Republicans have taken that they're not going to support any tax increase whatsoever? I mean, by taking such a dramatic stand in that way, doesn't it foreclose the possibility of negotiations where you could even have a token tax increase of some kind or a nominal increase and what might be even more stringent cuts to the budget, something that would appeal to Republicans naturally, but wouldn't foreclose there being some wiggle room to negotiate?
Well, to be honest with you, Larry, as you know, this isn't new. In our districts, people are convinced that government has had plenty of money to do the things that it needs to do. The difficulty is that there's not been the kind of restraint in spending that money. And so in our districts, there's been a huge pressure to say, listen, have government live within its means, particularly given the fact that it had to do with an excessive amount of spending, just like I have to in my home, that when we have down economic times, which we are in the middle of, as you know, the last thing people want to do is to pay more and more taxes and burden their families even more, given how far their dollars have to stretch. So, we're responding in our regions to those kind of critiques of how we spend our money, and I can't argue with it, to be honest with you, given the size of increases of spending that we've been doing.
So, Assemblyman Laird, I mean, given the kinds of political stances that the constituents in these Republican districts are taking, it seems pretty clear Republicans aren't about to move on this. So is it possible to for the state to cut its way out of this?
I don't think so. But first, let me go back and just correct some things that I don't think were true. The statement about what had been added to education and the statement about the growth in the budget over a period of time, there's a whole bunch of mitigating factors. I mean, in how much the budget went up over 4 years, the previous 2 years it went down. It actually went down, didn't cover the cost of inflation, didn't cover the cost in any change in expenses. And everybody says, oh, over 4 years it went up this much. And in many cases, what the voters have enacted in formulas requires that you come back to the level in good times. And when it was said how much was added in educational spending 2 years ago, a significant amount of that was one time. We did a one-time payment of back mandates that were owed to school districts. We did a one-time payment for economic impact aid to school districts. That was $1.1 billion alone. We did, when the revenue went up $7 billion in just 4 months, we put a majority of that into one-time costs. And one-time costs, it didn't affect ongoing formulas. And when you say what was the expenditure over 4 years, a significant amount was the new formula locked in for cities and counties. A significant amount was a highway formula that had never been locked in before. A significant amount was debt bonds, paying $3 billion a year that the voters approved in 2004 because the state was not put on a pay-as-you-go basis and $15 billion of debt was rolled forward. And when you go to the basic spending in medical care or schools, it was barely at the cost of inflation. But now to get back to your question,
yes.
I think that, you know, the trouble with our system and the two-thirds that empowers a minority in the budget is that what is empowered is a view that is not a majority view in the state and might not be sustained at a statewide level. And I think that's the balance we have to try to strike in the budget, is how do we respect the views of the minority, but how do we respect the views of might be the statewide view of the people of California. And that means we have to look across the aisle and come to a compromise.
Well, let's hear what AirTalk listeners have said. Really welcome your thoughts on what you would do if you were a legislator in Sacramento. What would you be pushing for as a way to close the budget gap here in the Golden State? We're at 866-893-KPCC. This is AirTalk.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by City of Hope, advising that every step is critical to curing breast cancer. From early detection and accurate diagnosis to less invasive surgical techniques that can lead to high survival rates and faster recoveries. If you have breast cancer, you can call 800-826-HOPE or you can ask your doctor for a referral. City of Hope, science saving lives.
This is 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Gary Shandling is on the witness stand this morning in the federal racketeering trial of former private eye Anthony Pelicano, accused of using illegal wiretaps on behalf of his clients and some top-notch entertainment attorneys. Prosecutors say Pelicano used a co-defendant, an ex-LA cop, to do an illegal background check on Shandling while he was involved in a lawsuit with his then-manager, Brad Gray, who's now head of Paramount. Jurors in the John Ritter wrongful death trial are deliberating this morning. Ritter's widow wants $67 million, claiming doctors misdiagnosed the actor, and as a result, his treatment worsened. That was already a dire situation. Ritter died of a torn aorta, but lawyers for the family claim doctors started treating him for a heart attack without even taking a chest X-ray. Taking a look at traffic in Carson on the 405 South before Avalon, there's a multi-car crash with injuries blocking the right lane. It's 1021.
Listen to Marketplace Money, the show about money for the rest of us, Sundays at 2 p.m. on KPCC, supported by Westcom Credit Union. If you live or work in Southern California, you can open a Westcom account. More information at westcom.org.
Programming is supported by Warner Independent Pictures, presenting Snow Angels, written for the screen and directed by David Gordon Green, a heartrending portrayal of the innocence and tragedy of love, starring Kate Beckinsale and Sam Rockwell. Opens this Friday at the Arclight and Landmark.
Good morning. This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. California's budget crisis and what it's going to take for the legislature in consultation with Governor Schwarzenegger to resolve it. I'm asking you, if you were up there and you were trying to come up with solutions to the budget gap, where would you start? What would you attempt to do? Rick in San Marino, you're on Air Talk.
Hey, Larry, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I've heard, and I'm not sure of the statistics, but for each prisoner we have in our prison system, it costs the state $25,000, $30,000 to $40,000 a person. Of those prisoners, a great number of them are not really those that you would consider harmful to society. They've been harmful to themselves in that they're basically drug abusers and things like that. And so I was wondering if there's a way of separating the taking away of the rights of somebody who deserves to be in prison and separate them into two camps, those that deserve to be in prison and those that deserve to be electronically under surveillance with leg irons or something like that.
Rick, let me just ask you, because I was under the impression with the initiative passed by California voters that allows people to take drug treatment in lieu of incarceration, that pretty much people who were in prison for drug offenses are people who are involved in the sales. They were businesses, drug businesses for them. Is that not right?
I'm not that familiar with the prison system. I'm just thinking we have an awful lot of people in the prison, and how could you take a look at them in some way that we cut the cost down?
Okay. Look, Rick Keene, your thoughts on this?
Well, yeah, I think there's a lot of room to look at some of those things. I think you're right, though, Larry, that with Prop 36, most of the low-level offenders are already currently being diverted. One of the conversations we just came up with is an example, which is kind of an unintended consequence, is that as we have shipped all these prisoners out of state, we're finding that the ones that Department of Corrections are shipping out of state are the ones that actually were working in communities doing fire suppression, fire breaks, a lot of community service stuff. So we've shipped our folks out that actually were helping in a lot of these communities, and we've kept these dangerous folks here in the state, which are high cost and don't really help us with our, you know, some of the other needs we have, so, which is kind of an odd policy. And we actually just have been learning about that. I think we're going to be having some discussions about it. And, you know, how does that affect our bottom line, and how can we cut some of the costs?
All right. John Laird, quick comment on this.
Yeah, the voters passed contradictory measures, and that's part of the problem, is that the Prop 36, the drug diversion, was passed, and I think that was good. And we've been fighting to keep implementing it. There have been pressures to not continue to fund it. At the same time, the voters passed three strikes. And three strikes is a de facto minimum for prisons, and it gets in the middle of some of the drug diversion if it turns out the third strike is related to one of these people in some way based on prior offenses. And it's just real difficult to work through the morass and try to meet the people's desire that the prisons not just incarcerate everybody with a drug problem.
Morty in Pasadena, you're on Air Talk with Assembly Members John Laird and Rick Keene.
Okay, thanks. So, try to be brief. My idea is to have a Save Our State Blue Ribbon panel established with, you know, well-respected Democrats and Republicans, maybe headed by a guy like Warren Buffett and headed by a guy like Pete Wilson, who just look at everything. Everything's on the table, including Prop 13, including the car tax, including the two-thirds vote situation, including all these referendums that we always have, and save our state, whatever it's going to take. Nobody's saying, hey, we ain't going to vote for taxes or we're not going to do this. Everything's on the table. It's well thought out. Then it's taken to the voters, and Warren Buffett and Pete Wilson say, this is what we think will save our state. We're going to ask you to vote for it, and it'll put on a referendum, let the people of California vote for it, Democrats and Republicans, and what if that passes, that's what we do. And it's just like we saved Social Security several years ago in the Congress when there was a big impasse, and I think we could do that in our state, and that way it would kind of take away this political battle.
Get out of the polarization politically. Yeah. Interesting idea. What do you think of that, Rick Keene?
Well, I mean, I certainly we want to have these kind of communications as to where we're going to be at, but there really is a fundamental difference an opinion as to how much government want and then how much are they willing to pay for, which sometimes is an inconsistent thought. A lot of folks want government to do more and more, but then they don't want to pay a higher bill, which I certainly can understand.
But what about putting together a panel like this of experts and having them weigh in and try and get as much representation across the spectrum, have members of the public involved, and to craft something outside of that kind of environment where you know everybody has to deal with party affiliation first and foremost?
Well, I don't know that there is so much. I mean, it's easy, I think, to articulate it as though it's a party affiliation issue, but it's really a philosophical issue. I mean, do we believe that, going from a $78 billion budget to $104 in that short a time is a wise idea? If that is not the case, then how big should it get? How much percentage of people's income should it take? And then what are the secondary impacts of that? That's kind of what we debate here in the legislature. And unfortunately, I sometimes think that people don't want to make the hard choices that come with that. And so they abrogate the responsibility by giving it to outside commissions and acting, asking the voters to vote on it. We really were elected to make these hard decisions, and unfortunately, I don't know that people are always willing to buck up and do it.
Well, I understand that. I mean, the other issue is you've got this two-thirds threshold necessary to pass any kind of a tax increase, which makes it extremely difficult. John Laird, your thoughts?
I think the suggestion's a great idea. I would throw in Leon Panetta and some of the people to broaden the spectrum. And the interesting thing is the public keeps voting for more services. They voted for Prop 98 for schools. They voted for Prop 42 for transportation. They voted for Prop 49 for after school. They voted for Prop 63 for mental health. They voted to spend more on sexual predators. You could go down the list, but then in the two-thirds environment, people don't actually vote to pay for what the public said they want to do. And part of the reason is you don't have a global look at everything together. And it's like, when you look at everything together, what are you willing to have as services and what are you willing to pay for? And if you ask the question, are you willing to pay for it, the answer might be different than some of these propositions. And I think it's going to take a global look to achieve this.
All right. Let's continue with Tom in Glendale. You're on Air Talk. Hi, Tom. What would you do if you were a member of the state legislature?
Good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
Good morning, Assembly members. Let's say it's an 8% cut or a 10% cut. I'd start with my salary, my staff's salary, all legislative expenditures. I would keep a hiring freeze on. I would allow open positions not to be filled. I'd go to the employee unions, the prison guards, and ask all of them to cut 10%, which is 4 hours, work a 36-hour week, so that none of their members would be laid off. And I'd close the state offices one day a week. If you go up and the DMV's closed on Friday, then you're starting to share the pain with the state, and people are starting to realize we're in a crisis. And then after that, start closing loopholes. Don't allow someone, and this is a current loophole, you can buy a yacht, you can berth it down below the border. If it's past a certain number of days, you can bring it into the state as a used yacht, not a new yacht, and you don't pay the sales tax.
Yeah, 90 days. We've actually talked about this, although it's 20-some million dollars. It's really more symbolic than it is an actual issue when you're looking at state revenue and the shortfall. But it's one that certainly has been brought up a lot by Democrats in the state legislature as exemplary of the kinds of things they think should be closed. What about those kinds of significant cuts, even cutting a day of the week for state offices to be open? Rick Keen?
Well, I think that stuff has to be on the table. And we've had a difficulty, although, to be honest with you, and Josh and I both did budget together, so we know this, but getting the state employees to come to the table and say they're willing to actually do that kind of stuff, given the legal protections that they have in collective bargaining, is a real issue. We can and will look at leaving positions open. We can and will look at not proceeding forward on new programs. All of that stuff will be on the table, and John will have to deal with it, and our side will have to deal with it as well. But I think that many of those ideas will have to be considered on how we're going to bridge this gap.
All right. John Laird, your thoughts on this, then we'll let both of you go.
I think many of those things are being done already. I mean, I personally don't take the full per diem payment. There's a 10% cut in the legislature, but if you defunded the legislature in its entirety, it would buy you back about 1/100th of the of the just the cut in Medi-Cal, and if you're talking about prison guards going from 40 to 36 hours, the real issue is the prisoners are there full time and they have to be tended. And if you cut back time of prisoners guards, somewhere more time has to come for prisoner guards. You just don't leave them untended for 4 hours. And so and the governor keeps doing hiring freezes and trying to keep from filling vacancies, but it doesn't seem to be very effective. The issues are so much larger that it's trying to deal with what the larger issues is. And I think what the people are going to demand is that we take some difficult steps this year, and I think it's got to be both new revenues and cuts, to upright this on an ongoing basis. We can't just keep rolling the problem forward and not dealing with it.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Good to talk with you both. Appreciate your weighing in on where this impasse stands in the state legislature.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you. Rick Keene, who is Republican member of the Assembly. He represents the coastal area of Monterey and Santa Cruz. And John Laird, Democratic Assemblyman, who chairs the Assembly Budget Committee. I'm sorry, John Laird is from Monterey and Santa Cruz. Excuse me. Rick Keene is from the Truckee area up there in Northern California. We're going to continue with your calls. Love to hear your recommendations. Phyllis in West Los Angeles, you're on Air Talk. What would you do?
Thank you. Good morning, gentlemen. It's very disturbing to consider cutting programs, and it's disturbing to consider raising taxes when people are already hurting in the current economic climate. But one thing I think we could all agree on is that the first thing that should be cut is waste. And in my experience, the people who know best where that waste could be eliminated are the people at the bottom. It could be the secretaries, the clerks, the people driving the trucks who know their job, and they know how their job could be improved. But in my experience in government, there are often disincentives to speak up because people are concerned about being laid off, or their supervisor may be concerned about being laid off and prevents them from suggesting changes of that type. I would go first to the people who are doing the work and ask them and incent them with a bonus of the annual saving for the first year if
All right.
they make a suggestion that can reduce expense to the state.
All right. Thank you very much, Phyllis. Appreciate that recommendation. Ed Honowitz is a member of the Pasadena Unified School District Board of Education. Ed, if you were an elected official, not in Pasadena, but in Sacramento, what would you advocate?
Well, I think one of the things that we absolutely need to do is to look at the recommendations that were made last year by the adequacy studies, which were sponsored by a number of foundations, and basically, the governor and the legislature wanted to take a look at the education funding system. What they concluded out of that study was that the California school finance system is overly complex and is not rationally aligned to support accountability and performance standards imposed on local educators. That's right out of the report. I think that when you look at how school districts are whipsawed back and forth based on the unstable funding, you get a lot of inefficiencies, and you know, we're already 46th out of 50 states in per pupil funding, and New York is spending 75% more per child than California. I think the other thing in terms of revenue is we need to look at letting the vehicle license fee go back to reset the way it originally was supposed to, which it's not as regressive a tax as some, and you know, that current cut, which Governor Schwarzenegger came into office with, would now be worth $6 billion in terms of additional revenue.
Okay.
I just think, in fact, it's immoral to have a state budget that is only solvent in boom times and then relies on cuts in services to children when the economy slows.
All right, Ed, thank you very much. We appreciate it. Pasadena Unified School Board member Ed Honowitz. Let me quickly offer some other suggestions. Les in West L.A. says Proposition 13, the portion that applies to business property, should be repealed so that businesses and corporations would have to pay an increasing tax associated with the increasing value of their properties. Dan in Van Nuys says there needs to be a change in the state constitution, moving away from that two-thirds majority requirement to pass a budget to make it a simple majority. And Gene in downtown L.A. says you have to be careful that that 12% cut that Assemblyman Keene was just talking about, that that doesn't become 24% because you have government matching funds on which often those dollars are predicated. So you shoot your foot yourself in the foot. Her argument, if you make even a 12% cut, the next thing you know, a quarter of the funding for a particular service is gone. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Time for us to check in with our Inland Empire trio of journalists. KPCC's own Inland Empire reporter, Stephen Cuevas, is with us. From the Press Enterprise of Riverside, columnist Cassie McDuff. And we welcome to the program from the Los Angeles Times, staff writer based in the Inland Empire, David Kelly. It's great to have you all with us. David, thank you very much. We appreciate your being with us.
Well, thank you very much for asking.
Well, let's begin right out of the bat with the testimony that was provided yesterday by Stephen Mendel, the president of Westland Meat, the company that operated that Chino slaughterhouse that was closed down, and the incredibly huge recall of ground beef from that slaughterhouse as a result of a Humane Society undercover investigation and apparently downed cattle making their way into the food supply. David, you want to start us off with this and what we learned from that testimony before Congress?
Well, I think what we learned was that Mr. Mendel wasn't telling us the truth the first time, or he didn't know what he was talking about the first time. He initially said there was no down cattle killed, and yet he contradicted himself yesterday when he was shown video of that, and he then subsequently told the panel that I was not aware of that, sir. So what you have is a totally different situation now. Even though getting contracting mad cow disease is very rare, and I think we've only had 10. Three cases in the last 10 years, but the fact is, now we don't know how much of that those cows were killed over the years. How much of that has gotten in the food supply, and it won't. It'll be 10 to 12 years before we ever really find out just the scope of this.
Well, and Cassie, I wonder about, you know, what's going to come out of this, because the issue seems less about what happened at this Westland Hallmark facility in Chino. The real issue is what's going to happen in the way of changes to the inspection process.
Well, that's what's been interesting at these congressional hearings on the topic. USDA Agriculture Secretary and Undersecretaries are all saying that the system works, there's no need for more inspectors, there's no need for any changes in the protocols. And I really think I don't think the Congress, the congressional members who are conducting these hearings are buying it. Obviously, there's a real problem if there were 5 inspectors assigned to this plant and none of them noticed that these animals were being abused this way and dragged into the kill box when they couldn't stand on their own.
And the other issue is, as we learned from journalistic accounts of what was happening, that the inspectors would come in, they'd see a very different slaughterhouse than what the workers experienced firsthand. We'll continue on this topic on Air Talk on KPCC.
Programming on KPCC is supported by Carlisle Wide Plank Floors, with a design center at 405 North Robertson Boulevard in the West Hollywood Design District. Carlisle handcrafts floors, one board at a time. Details at wideplankflooring.com.
We have a giveaway for you on KPCC. It's for a pair of tickets to a gypsy and belly dance performance at UCLA's Royce Hall, Saturday, March 22nd at 8 p.m. UCLA Live presents Tunisian dancer Lila Haddad and the Gypsy Musicians of Upper Egypt. The show features handmade costumes, nuanced lighting, and live music. Tickets and information at UCLALive.org. We'll take the third caller at 626-585-7893. L.A. County's population keeps growing, but its transportation system hasn't kept up. KPCC's Brooke Binkowski reports experts are looking ahead 25 years.
Traffic experts say that the average traffic speed will decrease 40% in the next 17 years if LA County doesn't do anything to accommodate population growth. By then, the county's anticipating 2.5 million more people. With that in mind, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority has released a long-range transportation plan. It includes about $153 billion in projects like freeway overhauls, railway extensions, and bicycle paths. The agency's already set aside the money for that. It's also seeking $60 billion from federal, state, and local governments to fulfill a transportation wish list. High on that list, the extension of the east-west subway line to the Pacific Ocean. Metro's also pushing to get people to change their commuting habits and use more public transit. The transportation agency's draft plan is available online for public comment at metro.net. Brooke Binkowski, 89.3 KPCC.
Speaking of commuting, in Highland Park right now, on the 110 North at Avenue 60, there's a three-car crash on the right shoulder, and it's going to be slow for commuters from Via Marisol. It's 10:41 at KPCC.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. The Inland Empire is our focus, looking at Riverside and San Bernardino counties, from the Coachella Valley all the way up to the high desert. We're with Cassie McDuff, columnist for the Press Enterprise of Riverside. We introduce David Kelly, who is from the Los Angeles Times, his staff writer reporting on the Inland Empire, and our own Stephen Cuevas from KPCC, our Inland Empire reporter. So, Stephen, back to the Westland hallmark and the testimony here. So you've got the U.S. government saying, we have an adequate inspection program. We have the case of the undercover Humane Society volunteer who was able to, you know, video document what happened at this plant, leading to this enormous recall. And you've got even people that have been interviewed in publications who work there at the slaughterhouse who say, well, yeah, whenever the inspectors come in, they see a whole cleaned up, totally different slaughterhouse. So how can this be fixed?
You're asking me?
And I'm asking you to do it right now in 5 minutes.
Well, good question. I really have no idea. What I do know is that I think what happened in Chino may just be something that's going on at the surface. I mean, according to the Humane Society, we do know that there are some other investigations going on. We don't know if they're looking at specific slaughterhouses around the country, but that's kind of what it sounds like. And in fact, Steve Mandel, in his testimony yesterday, let drop the name of the Humane Society investigator, at least the name he used when he was employed by Westland Hallmark, and went undercover. And that's of concern to the Humane Society because apparently this young man is doing some investigation elsewhere. All I can really answer to your question is more like, what does this mean locally? I mean, we do know that this is the end of this plant that employed well over 200 people, most of whom were laid off last month. And Steve Mandel said for the first time that the company is indeed ruined. I mean, that's the end. There's nowhere to go from here. And also the company, and I would presume upper management are facing possible criminal charges for possible unfair business practices. There are still some outstanding investigations going on by the county as well as the feds.
All right. Well, let's move our attention to health problems at the Chuckwalla Valley State Prison. More than 650 inmates have been stricken with flu-like symptoms, including fever, nausea, body aches, respiratory problems. This just in the past weeks. This is a 3,100-inmate facility, and you can only imagine if over a sixth of the population, about a fifth of the population there, is very sick with the flu. Cassie, what are they doing to try and contain things there?
Well, one thing that makes this prison unique is that the inmates live in dormitories rather than individual or two-person cells. So the spread of a disease like this just kind of whips like wildfire through the institution. Correctional officials are telling us this may be the largest outbreak of flu in state prison history. What they're doing is they've got the prison in lockdown. They're not accepting any new inmates. They're not allowing any visitation by family. Actually, they believe that this began in the community of Blythe, where about 800 people who work at the prison live, and then spread to the prison.
So workers probably brought it in, or family members potentially?
Exactly. And so the problem they've got now is how to contain it, keep it from spreading. Already they've had to hospitalize or place in the infirmary at least 25 inmates, and two who had flu-like symptoms have died. They're not saying that they died of this outbreak, but they are having autopsies and trying to determine that. So it's a very serious situation, and they're trying to get a handle on it. I think everybody knows this has been a terrible flu season. Communities throughout the country have been suffering. The flu shots didn't really address the strains of flu that have come out, and so it's a pretty widespread problem everywhere. But when you've got a prison,
all the more.
They're having to have the inmates dine in shifts and disinfect the cafeteria in between shifts and disinfect all the common areas. So they're doing what they can.
Do you know if they give inmates flu shots on an annual basis just to try and ward off this kind of thing?
I was
curious if
they do. Have not heard that, but I know that they are now offering all the inmates vaccinations as of this week. But
might be worth the money to do it, I mean, given the cost that they're having to deal with now, certainly.
Certainly at a prison that houses inmates this way.
Yeah, 3,100 of them at the Chuckwalla Valley State Prison. And we want to update you on what's happening at Duraville. This is the rundown mobile home park on the Torres Martinez Indian Reservation in the southern Coachella Valley. The park, home to thousands of migrant workers, and has been cited for dangerous conditions because of faulty electrical lines, dumping of water that's polluted, all kinds of problems with potential health and safety issues there. David, what is the latest in terms of what the court is doing trying to clean up Duraville?
Well, U.S. District Court Judge Stephen Larson has appointed a provisional receiver, and that's a nice way of saying it, a temporary boss for the next 2 months, a man named Mark Adams, who's a lawyer from Santa Monica. His job is to go in there and take care of the most immediate emergency situations, clean up the most immediate hazards. He's sent electricians, plumbers to all the 276 trailers. They found 30 or 40 that were imminent hazards, life-threatening conditions. They've tried to fix those. He's drained four of the eight backed-up sewage ponds, which are essentially enormous outdoor toilets filled with sewage, human waste. He's drained four of those. He has probably another month, 30 days, to come up with a report, which he will submit to the judge and make his recommendations on whether or not that place can stay open or should be closed. I mean, as you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office has wanted it to be closed. They say it poses an immediate risk to its inhabitants.
But where do you put the thousands of people who live there?
That's what Judge Larson said, and he asked the U.S. Attorney Leon Weidman, Assistant U.S. Attorney, in court. He said, well, what are we going to do with these 6,000 people? And Leon Weidman said, to everyone's astonishment, well, that's not our problem, Officer, Your Honor. And the judge was just appalled by that. And the judge was really an interesting guy. He's born in Fontana, and he went out there. He went out and personally toured the place, you know, followed with this retinue of U.S. Marshals carrying M-16s and whatnot. But he wanted to see it for his own eyes, and he came away clearly appalled by it. But he knows you just can't get rid of 6,000 people. There are 40,000 people on a waiting list for only 30 available affordable housing units in the Coachella Valley. So that's the kind of, it would be a catastrophe, literally a disaster, and if those people were put out on the street. So, these are the poorest of the poor. These are people who make maybe $15,000 a year in a good year when they're working. And now, because of last year's freeze, a lot of them are only working a few hours a day. So, I mean, it's a bad situation. Mark Adams wants to save the place, but ultimately it could come down to what the EPA finds in soil samples, which they're doing this week, actually.
So looking at potential toxic contaminants.
Yeah, they found asbestos, they found PCBs, they found levels of dioxin, which are all carcinogens at, you know, 5-10 times the national average there. And that can't be fixed. So that could sink the place, ultimately.
All right. Stephen, you know, we talked about this before, and the question sort of was, well, where are the agricultural companies that employ these people? And David referencing the fact that they're not employing as many of them because the crops were smaller because of adverse weather conditions. But has there been any role at all for the ag companies that employ the residents of Duraville in this court proceeding?
Not that I know of. I mean, David might know more about that. But, I mean, this has been an ongoing problem out in the Coachella Valley, and it's not just what's happening in Duros. I mean, in nearby Mecca. I mean, there were residents who set up, temporary little shanties, if you will, in their front yards or backyards. They open their garages and they'll rent out to some of these migrant workers with no permits. And the county kind of looks the other way because there is no alternative right now. There's very little affordable housing. You know, some immigrant rights people I've talked to have said, well, to their credit, the county has made some inroads, but, you know, after so many years of ignoring this problem, you can't just catch up in a year or two. So they're starting to plan now for possible closure. And what does that mean? And what they're hoping is if the judge does indeed decide to close the place down, that it'll happen in stages, perhaps over 18 months or 24 months. So as affordable housing does become available, if it does, mm-hmm. then some of the residents, especially those with kids and older folks, can move into more suitable habitat because it is very bad out there. That said, you also get, if you walk around and talk to people, you do get kind of a sense of community. A lot of the people are from the same state in Mexico. A lot of people know each other. They get referred there. So yes, it's unsafe in many of the ways David said, but there people also just feel safe among each other. There isn't, as far as I know, a lot of crime. There have been problems in the past with burglary, but you know people get along pretty well.
Okay, all right. We'll see what happens in Duraville. Meantime, farther to the west, the city of Ontario has set up an area near an airport runway for use as a rest area by the homeless. Ontario, in a sense, opening up this area, giving the homeless a place to eat, sleep, and live unmolested, essentially. Toilets have been provided, water, food, tents, and showers. The place has expanded to over 300 people, and now the city is starting to think maybe this was too much of what looked like a good thing early on. David Kelly, what is going on in the debate in Ontario over this tent city near the airport?
Yeah, well, it's like you said, it was a good idea at the time. This was something that no one expected out of a pretty conservative city, Ontario. This was something you would expect more at a place like Santa Monica or Berkeley. Most cities like to get rid of their homeless, they like to shoo them away. Ontario decided to get them out of the shadows and give them their own place to live. And it was they trumpeted this when it first started, and now people started coming in and more, and it went from 13 people to 28 people to now maybe 350, depending on who's counting. And clearly, now they're parking. The city feels this is growing beyond its grasp, and they're starting to find ways to thin it out. And in the last week, they've been towing away a lot of the motorhomes and vans that a lot of the homeless people have been living in along the streets. And now there's rumors that they're going to issue wristbands, although they have denied this to people saying where they come from. Mm-hmm. The city would like this to be for Ontario homeless, not for the homeless for the entire region.
Well, yeah, they don't want a magnet where everybody comes there because it's a nicer place to live as a homeless person.
Yeah, and it's not that nice. It's full of tents, and there's wild dogs running around. I've met six-year-old children there. I've met pregnant women. So this is not a Shangri-La by any means, but it is a place where they're all together, and they could all be sort of serviced for the various mental health issues and drug dependency issues that many of them have.
Cassie, your thoughts on Ontario and the difficult issue it faces with this?
Well, I thought it was commendable that Ontario decided to do something like this. It puts homeless people in a somewhat safe area where social service agencies and charities can come in and help them get located in permanent housing. It's also surprised me that Ontario did it, because every city that I'm aware of in this area has grappled with the homeless issue and said, we don't want to build anything that's going to become a magnet. So now Ontario, I guess, is, as David says, rethinking and maybe scaling back, or at least trying to limit it to its own homegrown homeless.
All right. Also want to mention, as the Democratic Party is figuring out what to do with Florida and Michigan, where the primaries there were decertified, and now, of course, they would be of grave import to one or both of the candidates if they could count those. But in Riverside County, it had its own problems, a sort of bubble trouble incident like in Los Angeles, but in this case wasn't actually the bubble that caused the problems like in L.A. where they couldn't count the votes. It was a disappearance of a box full of ballots that had actually been filled out. This is on the Coachella Valley on the night of the primary election. Cassie, what's going on? They can't find these ballots?
Well, as I understand it, the latest report that I have seen is that indeed they have located the ballots. Apparently what happened was these carload of young men saw an election worker putting the ballot box in her car, and they must have thought there was something valuable in there and grabbed her purse and grabbed the ballot box and drove away, and then were pretty quickly located, actually, by the Border Patrol when a all-points bulletin went out. And but by then, the box was empty. And now
they sold the ballots on the black market. Oh, my God.
Well, I understand the registrar is now saying that those were all either ballots that had not been voted or were spoiled, and that only one that has been recovered had been voted, but it was so damaged that it couldn't be read. So essentially 119 ballots either were not voted or were not counted. But as the registrar said, or assistant registrar said, it's not enough to have changed the result of the election. So kind of sad. But, you know, these are both counties are big, far-flung, and ballots are brought in. Actually, in San Bernardino County, the volunteer pilots fly them from one end of the county into the central registrar's office. And occasionally a ballot box goes missing, whether by a criminal act like this or by an election worker being too tired and driving home instead of going down to the registrar's office. But it happens from time to time.
Well, there are an awful lot of state elections that cover a smaller area than does San Bernardino County. So, yeah, no question. And finally, I want to talk about Temecula. For 22 years, they've had this classic car show I've attended. It's a lot of fun, called the Rod Run. But there was a shooting involving an off-duty Costa Mesa police officer who shot one man, killing him, wounded another. This was at a new restaurant that opened up. And some folks in town are saying, hey, this thing has outgrown its original intentions. It does bring a lot of tourists and business to Temecula. But this is a rapidly growing city, and they're concerned that it's not working out. David Kelly, share with us just a bit more about this debate.
Well, it's like you said. I was speaking to merchants down there recently, and they said this year's was the biggest they've ever had. There were thousands of people. The streets were jammed, and a lot more drunken, rowdy behavior. People are, you know, on top of cars in some cases. Not
I didn't go this year, so I was not one of the drunken and rowdy. I just want to clarify.
Well, not all. I mean, we don't want to stereotype. But most people weren't doing that, but it is getting bigger. Then you had this incident at the Bank of Mexican Food where this off-duty police officer is said to have touched some woman by mistake, depending on who you speak to, and the guy, there's a fight that spilled out later onto the street, and the police officer was allegedly hit with a bar stool, and he fired and hit two men, and one guy died. And the guy who died, Sean Villain, had done 6 years in Soledad State Prison for assault with a deadly weapon. He beat somebody in the face with a beer bottle.
We'll see what happens. This has been a very popular event in the southwestern Riverside County town of Temecula. This is Air Talk on KPCC. Thanks to our Inland